He co-wrote the book What You Didn't Know About the Most, the 100 Most, do that again. All right, here we go. Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Pett. What's the best beginner's book to learn about church history? Back in 2016, there wasn't one, so Dr. Casey Griffiths set out to make one. So he's the author, co-author of What You Don't Know About the 100 Most Important Events in Church History. So we're going to talk about this book, as well as some of the amazing things over the past two centuries. I'm also going to be giving away a copy of his newest book, 50 Relics of the Restoration. So if you'd like to win an autographed copy of this book, go ahead and sign up to gospeltangents.com/Casey, that's C-A-S-E-Y, and you could win a copy of this fantastic book. So now back to our conversation. One of the things that I love about your new book is it's kind of like your old book. We haven't talked about your old book, which is, why don't you go ahead and show that one to us? And how old is that book, by the way? I've had that for quite a while.
This book was published in 2016.
Okay, and so it's not that old.
What You Don't Know About the 100 Most Important Events in Church History. And that is a long title, right? And almost all of our reviews are like, that is an awkward title. Well, the background behind it is I was looking for an entry-level book in church history for people. My entry-level book in church history was Church History in the Fullness of Times, which was the Institute Manual, which I just thought was fascinating. Like on my mission, I would split my study between Church History in the Fullness of Times and the Book of Mormon. Like, and I got so excited about it. But I came back and I was serving as a bishop, and I had someone come up to me and say, hey, what's the first church history book that I should read? And I sort of realized, gosh, it was hard to find something that was entry level for people. This was before Saints was published, by the way. And right. I think they kind of had the same idea as us. But I was like, what's a book that in one volume we could cover all the major events of the church? Because another problem I have sometimes, too, is that we have this major bias towards the 19th century. Like, for instance, the first article I published was on an event that took place in the 1920s. And my dad said to me, like, has anything really interesting happened after Brigham Young died? And I kind of went, a lot of stuff that's interesting has happened after Brigham Young died. So in one volume, we wanted to cover the classics, the martyrdom of Joseph Smith, the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. And then we wanted to cover some stuff that's really important, but that people don't talk about as much. And so in grad school, I had a book called The 100 Most Important Events in Christian History that covered everything from the crucifixion of Jesus Christ to the Council at Nicaea. Oh. And we thought it would be nice if there was something like this for the history of the church that just basically said, here's 100 things that happened that were a big deal. And that would allow us to draw people in by saying, we're going to talk about the first vision, which they were familiar with, but we're also going to talk about the first female missionaries. We're also going to talk about the correlation movement, which isn't the sexiest thing to discuss, but it's really important if you want to understand how the modern church works. So me with Mary Jane, my co-author, and Susan Easton Black helped us on this book as well, sat down and just had arguments about what we thought was the 100 most important events. And obviously, you know, some things like the coming forth of the Book of Mormon or the restoration of the priesthood were always on the list. But where we had a lot of fun was kind of arguing in the 20th century what was a big deal. Like David O. McKay in 1920 goes on this tour of all the missions. He's assigned to visit every single mission of the church, and he's gone for a year.
As an apostle,
yes. So he goes to Egypt, and he visits with church members in Armenia, and he spends a lot of time in the Pacific, specifically visiting the saints there. Now, that might seem like just a lark that an apostle went on, but David O. McKay is sort of recognized as the international father of the church, that when he becomes president of the church in the 1950s, he really has this international lens that he's seeing the church through. And he's thinking about more than just the American membership of the church. He's thinking about how he can bless the members of the church in other nations and what he can do to try and help them. And President McKay's international emphasis is what kind of starts us to set up the structures, the international education systems and the welfare systems, and just having a chapel in your town in the Netherlands is a big deal. The President McKay's formative experience there, which doesn't seem like a big deal at the time, really was a big deal in the overall history of the church. And the problem with that was the closer we got to the present, the harder and harder it was to sort of say, is this going to be a consequential event for the history of the church? For instance, Mary Jane and Susan and I all argued about the missionary age change in 2012. Like I was saying, they've changed the missionary age a bunch of times. It doesn't really seem like it's that big a deal to me. So I was arguing, hey,
from 19 to 18.
From 19 to 18, I was like, what's the big deal? You know, we've always sent out missionaries and the ages have changed, and I don't really see this as being something that is consequential in the history of the church. Mary Jane and Susan both argued that it wasn't the 19 to 18 change. It was the 21 to 19 change for women that changed it. Like, they pulled out a couple statistics that noted the shift in the missionary force of the church. That it had gone from being about 4-1 for males to being about a 50-50 split between males and females. And they pushed back by saying, don't you think that having so many more female returned missionaries is going to have an impact on the church? And I had to kind of back off and say, yeah, it seems like that is going to be consequential in the overall history of the church, that in the history of age changes, that might be the most significant age change that's happened so far. Because I started as an adjunct instructor at BYU in 2012, and I had a lot of returned missionaries, but almost none of my female students were returned missionaries. You know, a woman has generally completed or is close to completing her college studies by the time she's 21. Now almost all of my female students are returned missionaries. And that has really shifted the discussion. You've got a significantly higher number of women that are engaging in ecclesiastical assignments, that are working with the ecclesiastical structure of the church. Because a missionary, you know, serving as a missionary is an apprenticeship. You have to see how a bishop operates and how a Relief Society president operates, and you see the structure of the church. And I've had a lot more women in my classes asking deep and consequential questions about the nature of priesthood, about what priesthood means and what their place is within the church and the role of women. I don't think it's a coincidence that since then, teachings about Heavenly Mother have become more consequential, more to the forefront within the church. And so that's 2012. I mean, that was 9 years ago. It's really hard as a historian to say that something that happened 9 years ago is going to be a big deal, but I think that Susan and Mary Jane really made their case that that could be a very consequential thing. And it's probably going to be one of those things that people look back and go, was that a big deal? And we might have to argue and say, well, maybe we were wrong, but we're at least putting it out as here's the reasons why we think this could be a really big deal. Another example would be Brigham Young's priesthood reorganization in 1877. Nobody talks about that. And nobody talks about how consequential Brigham Young was in actually creating the church that we exist in. So, for instance, in 1877, there are wards and there are bishops. But the idea that a ward has an elders quorum and a relief society and priesthood quorums and a young men's and young women's organization attached to it didn't exist. Those were all separate organizations out off doing their own thing. And in 1877, just a couple months before he died, Brigham Young felt pressed by revelation to reorganize the ward structure of the church so that there was a bishop over every ward. The ward had a geographical boundary, and attached to every ward was a relief society, an elders quorum, a young men's organization, and a young women's organization. Now, take away those things, and the church looks a lot different than it does today. So while that might not be kind of as amazing as a pillar of light in the function and the day-to-day structure of the church, it's a huge thing that we wanted people to know.
So that's interesting because, you know, earlier we were talking a little bit about the Community of Christ, and they have a pastor over every ward.
Yeah, yeah.
But a bishop is a separate calling, and a bishop is over several congregations,
yeah,
as I understand it. In fact, there's one out here. I'm trying to remember what her name is.
Probably Carla Long.
Carla Long.
Yeah,
yes,
I
need.
Carla.
I'm trying to get
She's
her
awesome.
On my podcast.
Carla, yeah.
She's a math major too.
Yeah. Oh well,
I'm a
you
math
guys,
major.
You guys would connect. Right?
So So that community of Christ with a bishop over several wards, mm-hmm. is that what it was like before 1877?
Yeah, I mean, community of Christ, that was another thing that spurred on the book, was my interaction with community of Christ, to realize you can start with the same set of scriptures and come to a really different conclusion. Seeing their structure and the way that they have developed is kind of a nice kind of lab experiment to show how consequential the other presidents of the church besides Brigham Young have been. Besides Joseph Smith have been. In the church, we tend to simplify everything down to Joseph Smith got a revelation, and that's why we do the way we do it in the day. And honestly, I am amazed at the fidelity we show to the Doctrine and Covenants. We definitely take everything in the Doctrine and Covenants seriously, but we also discredit the fact that revelation has continued, and that presidents of the church after Joseph Smith received revelation and seriously changed the church in ways that sent us off in new and exciting directions. When you look at Community of Christ, and the pastor-bishop model is a good example of this, it's clear to see that we can't just say the church was wholly revealed to Joseph Smith and that's what we do today. It's that there's been little adjustments, little revelations, little changes all along the way.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Casey Griffiths. In our next conversation, we're going to talk about how sometimes the gospel gets mixed up with American culture.
I have a friend who works in educational groups in Africa. And in Africa, the idea that a husband and wife would kiss in public, in certain parts of Africa, is just taboo. It's pornographic. Like, they would see it as,
oh, really?
As terrible. Yeah. And he told this story where this local American leader of the church was worried that the husbands and wives weren't expressing enough affection. And so he held the fireside, and he brought his wife up front, and he gave her a big kiss in front of the congregation and said, I want all of you to do this. And the entire congregation was just sitting there, like, horrified. Like, how can we do this? Well, we'd have to go back to the earlier question of, is kissing your wife in public a facet of the gospel? It's really not, right? It's something that is part of American culture, and in America is a good way of expressing your affection and love for your spouse, but it's not necessarily something that we have to transfer somewhere else.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, sign up at patreon.com/gospeltangents, and for $5 a month, you can hear the entire interview without any interruptions. If you'd like to see the whole video, that's just $8 a month, and you can sign up either at youtube.com/gospeltangents or on our website at gospeltangents.com and click the yellow subscribe button. Or you can go to patreon.com/gospeltangents, and I'll just need to make sure that we're Facebook friends, and I'll add you to our insiders group, and you can see the entire interview uncut. If you'd like to get PDF transcripts of our interviews, those are just $10 a month. And for just $15 a month, I will send you paperback versions of our transcripts as soon as they come out. Or, of course, you can buy them on Amazon as well. Go to Amazon.com and do a search for Gospel Tangents Interview, and you can see all of our transcripts there. Don't forget to sign up for our updates at facebook.com/gospeltangents. Of course, you can follow us at Gospel Tangents on Twitter. To hear our interviews updated to your podcast player, go to tinyurl.com/gospeltangents and make sure you give us a 5-star review. And of course, you should show your support for Gospel Tangents with one of these cool t-shirts, like this green one, or light blue, sport gray, royal blue, purple, of course black, beautiful gold, and of course Utah red. I've probably left out some colors, but if you want to see more, go to gospeltangents.com/shop and you can get one of these. So once again, thanks for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some more of our great videos. Thanks again.